Welcome back to the Ultimate Men's Summit. This is your co-host, Lyon Goodman. I am very pleased to be here on a Saturday morning with Claudio Naranjo, an amazing man who has written 20 books and has been a pioneer in the human potential movement. I'll tell you more about him in just a moment. Just a few logistical things. The recordings of all of our calls this past 8 days are on our calendar page, and if you missed any of the talks, and how could you not with over 80 of them, you can listen to them either on the web or by downloading them to your MP3 player and playing them on your on the ski slopes or on the treadmill or doing housework or whatever you do in the car. Amazing resource filled with brilliant conversations with some of our leading thinkers, luminaries, and authors in these issues of about men, masculinity, and the world. And also we invite you to participate on our Facebook page, The Shift Network on Facebook. It's a great way to continue the conversation, ask questions, make suggestions, and share your own thoughts. We're very, very happy to announce that tomorrow Robert Moore is joining us at 12:30. He was our last. We're saving a spot for him, and he's going to be our closing speaker, talking about the men's movement for the past 20 years, and what we need to learn as men and about initiation. And after that, we're going to be opening the phone lines and talking about honoring our fathers. We're going to allow you to honor your father live and publicly, whether your father's around or passed on. It'll be an opportunity for all of us to give some homage to the father energy in our lives. And that's what we're going to be talking about with Claudio. I'll tell you a bit about him if you don't already know his work. Claudio studied medicine and music and philosophy in Chile and then became a physician and went into psychiatry. And he came to the U.S. to look at the human potential movement at Esalen Institute, where he became one of the successors to Fritz Perls. And he then moved into spiritual teachings and met with spiritual masters, including Tartong Tulku Rinpoche and many other teachers. He has a long, long list of people in the human potential movement that he had contact with, studied with, taught, or practiced with. He's published 20 books, among which are Healing Civilization and The Way of Silence, and a book that he's written called The Patriarchal Mind, which has not yet been published in English, but we're hoping to see that one soon. He has explored psychopharmacology and psychedelic therapy. He has taught at many schools, including UC Santa Cruz, CIIS in this country, and he's also taught in many other countries. He's taught therapists how to be better therapists, not only by learning more, but actually by experiencing more and looking into themselves. And one of his passions now is education, bringing that education of the conscious mind and the subconscious mind into regular education. So, Claudio, I'm very, very pleased to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased, too. I'm quite ignorant of the men's movement, so I'm getting an education.
Good.
Listening these days. And I am excited at the idea of stimulating the men's movement to engage patriarchy and not only to develop personally, which of course we all need, but perhaps to raise this banner of helping the world becoming active socially to change the patriarchal ways.
Yeah, that's one of the themes that we've had repeatedly throughout our summit, and that is that we do need to take care of our inner work first, but then there's outer work too. We have to take it from the personal to the interpersonal, into our relationships, our families, and then into the social world, into our institutions. And so tell us a bit about how you came to this particular topic. You've studied so many things, so
yes.
You've looked so deeply into human potential and what's possible. How did you come to this study of the social problem of patriarchy?
I came to it not through seeking. I came through, I might say, through a providential encounter. A man who is little known still today in the books. I have been writing about him. He was an artist called Totila Albert, born in Chile of a German family. He was known as a sculptor, but he used to say sculpture was his profession and his vocation poetry. He had written at the time I ran into him an epic poem of proportions greater than the Divine Comedy on his own journey. He called it The Birth of the Self. And he was a self-realized person, and he was very isolated in Chile. That I know, he was the first enemy of patriarchy, the first, I don't know, that's the word I want to use, something like somebody who indicts patriarchy, because he was influenced by Bachofen, the discoverer of matriarchy, of who was a historian mainly. And but Bachofen was not critical of patriarchy. He, like others even today, saw patriarchy as a step forward, like the birth of civilization is usually seen as a step forward in human evolution. And even before, it was clear through archaeology that patriarchy is the time when social inequality came into the world and massive killings, wars. Even before that, it was very clear to him that this was the root cause of all human problems, that what today is called the world problematique, adopting the Club of Rome terminology, because this many-faceted world problem, to him, had this particular root, patriarchy. And he was very passionate about that, and I was about 20 years old when he was about 60. And he became a mentor to me.
Let's take a moment and define patriarchy, because like the archy part of the word is obviously rule by, like monarchy,
yes,
or oligarchy, and pater is father, so and it's also the root of the word pattern, or structure. So we have the father aspect or the masculine aspect of the universe in pattern and in fathering. And so it seems to mean the rule by the fathers.
Rule by, I think, is a good way. Like anarchy, it would be the rule each person by to rules himself. And you could say tribal matristic cultures have tribal rule, group government. So patriarchy is the rise of central government, central authority.
But it's most of the central authoritarian organizations are more like what we have today, which is an oligarchy or a plutocracy,
in which
the powerful are ruling and everybody suffers under it. The serfs suffer under the king, both male and female. So
yes, there is a book about biography of Cicero I saw recently. I got in an Italian airport, and the subtitle was, that in history everything changes, but power is always the same.
Right, it seems to accumulate at the top. And I think one of the complaints I've heard most often this week in all these discussions about patriarchy is that people have taken this idea that the powerful men were rulers over everyone, and that this idea came to be associated with men themselves, even though men were as subjected in these top-down hierarchies as women. So would you speak to that and how you see it in terms of is it rule by the powerful men or rule by all men?
I would say the two more striking theories of the origins of patriarchy I find are, one, the Saharasia hypothesis. I don't know how acquainted you may be with that.
Not at all. So you'll have to tell me. I don't know anything about that.
Well, there was a time when the earth was practically covered with ice at the end of the last glaciation, and only the area from the Sahara to Ukraine, passing through the Middle East, was was good for agriculture. So this was the area where the first communities arose, agricultural sedentary communities. Today we call them matristic rather than matriarchal, because it was not a case of dominance by powerful women, but a dominance of feminine values, like the value of fertility, the value of equality, social bonds, relatedness, and empathy. So there was something like a Garden of Eden stage in human life, but it has been quite well established that the warming up of the earth that happened later didn't allow for the for the sufficiency of agriculture in this region, and gave rise to migrations. And during these migrations, there was famine and the need to survive a very difficult situation of scarcity. And this was the beginning of violence, the need to become, apparently this was the beginning of patriarchy. The men took the lead in becoming warriors, predatory warriors.
It came out of insufficiency of supply.
Yes,
then. So
yes.
You had to go raid someone else's territory in order to feed your own tribe.
And after a sedentary existence, there arose a new nomadism. And these were the first barbarians, we might say. And we are the descendants of these first barbarians, only that we have taken this attitude, this conquering attitude, and this insensitivity that was necessary to develop in order to leave the weak behind or to kill others for personal survival. This became very idealized. All religions have sacrificed this, and it's one of the mysteries that one of the sources of speculation, the history of religions, why sacrifice it? It was as if there was a need to make violence sacred in order to be able to reconcile oneself with something so unnatural. So this is one theory, this Saharasia hypothesis. I think it's very convincing because it also explains not only violence and the toughening and the repression of empathy, but the turning against what is natural. We are mostly, the civilized world is ascetic, is anti-body, has lost trust in instincts.
Right, certainly anti-sensual and
anti-sensual.
Right, the major world religions have said, you know, go to the spirit, go up, go to heaven, don't go down. Down is bad, earth is bad, body is bad.
So an experience of hunger does that to the mind. One has to not mind one's hunger. One has to learn not to mind one's impulses, not to mind one's body. So that's one theory. And the other is quite well researched, how all our languages practically come from the Indo-European that basically is southern Russia. It's what more or less where Ukraine is. And the Indo-Europeans were successful because they domesticated horses and they invented the war chariot. So there was a superior technology to other peoples that allowed all these Indo-European migrations into Greece, into India, into practically all the known world, and the dominion of the matristic peoples that came before.
So the god, so whatever cultures there were in the matristic cultures or matrilineal or goddess oriented cultures, got invaded and taken over because they weren't developing technology.
Yes.
They weren't developing defenses, and so.
So it was a dominion of guile, strategy, technology, and strategy. It seems that this was a very masculine movement, and it's echoed in myth also, like Apollo, or let's say Perseus and the Medusa. There's a very well-known story of how Perseus cuts the head off the Medusa, who has this hair in the form of snakes.
Right, and he can't look directly at her. It's almost as if the masculine can't look the feminine directly in the eye, you know, because
feminine has a paralyzing effect.
Right, right. And I've noticed that in my life. I don't know if you've noticed that in yours, but
probably originally matriarchy was, or the matristic order was seen by the rising patriarchy as too stable, too resistant to change, too paralyzing. And the men had to empower themselves to do something new and something revolutionary, and break all the rules.
Yeah, so the goddess cultures apparently lasted perhaps, I don't know, 100,000 years or so,
yeah.
and that was a stable time. Yet it also didn't budge much. It was the same. Always, it didn't have. The circle was secure, but there was no arrow to pierce it. There was no forward movement.
I think I should mention the Totila Albert's view of history briefly.
Yeah.
He coincided with Bachhoff, and there had to be something before the Neolithic and agriculture, and this, which Engels wrote as a primitive communism, he called it filiarchy, because it looks like when we were not governed by tribes, when it was not the human group that became the source of decisions. The time of self-rule, the anarchic, is a little bit the dominance of the child principle within. Then the government by the tribe, the democratic government of the matristic times, you could say, is matristic, and patriarchy. So there's a succession of the rule of the child, the rule of the mother, and the rule of the father, not just the matriarchy and patriarchy, but the three persons in the family are very much the projection of three aspects of everybody's mind.
But did you say? Did you start off by saying theistic? That's what I thought you'd said when you were talking about the child mind. Rule by God or rule by the
no
by spirit?
Filiarchy. The rule by the child. Well, probably when people were ruled, when people have this ideology that each rules over his own domain, this was perceived as each person doing God's will. The Jewish prophets, for instance, they didn't want kingship, and they had a sense that the only king is God, and each individual should have an intuition of what God wants. So
But by the time we got to the Jewish prophets, we were already in the world of kings,
yes,
and everyone else. So we were already in a patriarchy model, So if they were saying we shouldn't, there was only one king, God was still king.
I mean prophets before the establishment of kingship. Kingship started with King Saul and then King David, but there were prophets before, and the time of the judges. The Jewish people resisted the idea of having kings like the Babylonians or the Egyptians and the other people. There was a remnant of the idea that there should be no king on earth, but only a heavenly king. A remnant was a very ancient way of feeling.
So come back to this
even
idea.
Even though the patristic times had finished.
Come back to this idea that that there's three types of rule, father, mother, child, and both an externalization of these ideas and an internalization of these ideas. Tie those things together.
Yes. Well, today we have heard a lot about three brains. Since MacLean established that there are three levels of in the evolution of the brain, so the instinctive brain, the basic brain, is very similar in humans and in reptiles, and that then there comes a mammalian brain, a part of the brain we share with mammals, which is the midbrain, and it's related to love because mammals are the beings that we might say it introduced love in the biological world through the bond between mother and child. The bond between mother and child is the first bond where there is a sense of you, or the sense of the other as similar to self. We might say love of neighbor begins with mothering. The reptilian or instinctual brain, the relational brain of mammals, and then the neocortex, the modern brain, the human brain proper that makes us Homo sapiens.
So we have the survival instincts, which are basically asking three questions. Can I eat it? Can it eat me? And can I mate with it? Those are the three basic survival questions.
Right.
Then on top of that, and you have the emotional brain, the limbic system, and as you're saying, there's a kind of nurturing. Although there are some reptiles like alligators who do take care of their baby reptiles, but most reptiles kind of, you know, there's enough instinct that they just go off and take care of themselves.
But
the emotional brain, and then on top of that, the intellectual brain or the cortex, the neocortex.
So these are the three functions that psychology has always recognized: the instinctual, the emotional, and the cognitive. But you can also say there are like three spirits within us, or three persons within us. And that was the Totila Albert view of it, that we have the intellectual brain is a little bit like the inner father, not only the father that generates ideas, looks to heaven in some way, but it takes authority over the inner world. There is a biological advantage over... just like the intellectual brain sits on top of the rest of the nervous system, there's also a hierarchical structure to the nervous system. And the intellectual is meant to have dominion over what's below, like the charioteer that has the reins of the horse.
Right.
And the midbrain, the mammalian brain, has to do with mothering. It's like the inner mother. And you could say the instinctual brain is like the inner animal, but also the inner child, which is pure instinct before culture. But these three are not really integrated in our patriarchal brain. Because of living in an authoritarian society, has made us more more oriented to reason. Education, you could say, is a kind of imperialism of reason.
Well, even language itself is a cortical function, right? You could say a patriarchal function or a top-down function in which objects are named and thereby organized, taken apart, and put back together. So our language is oriented towards nouns, toward things and objects, whereas other languages may be more oriented toward processes or feelings or emotion.
Yes, and we have then become relatively alienated, particularly alienated with regard to the instinctual brain. We have become exploiters of nature, not only outside but inside too. We treat our inner animal like a beast of burden.
Right, the body is just something to carry the head around, right?
Yes. We have criminalized instinct or pleasure. Instead of recognizing that instinct or pleasure are like the tropisms of a plant that knows wisely how to orient to the sun or send its roots to where there is water in the distance, instead of honoring pleasure as a kind of wisdom of the body, patriarchal, not it's only education, but upbringing, inculcates a sense that behavior should be ruled from conditioning, from control, from every impulse needs to be filtered as if it were a potential criminal.
And in many of the talks we've had this week, people have said that, you know, there are differences between male and female brains, that there's differences in terms of upbringing of children, and that children thrive best when they have both a mother and a father influence.
Yes.
Where the mother is more nurturing and the father is more clear with boundaries. Those are kind of the typical ways that mothers and fathers raise their children.
It's true.
The masculine, the feminine. So it's as if children need both, that more naive instinct needs to have both a sense that I am here, I'm nurtured, and also a sense of, hey, I need to gain some control over my actions and reactions.
This semanticist, what's his name, Lakoff, you know, in his studies of conservatism in America.
Right. The strong father model versus
yes.
Parent, the nurturing parent model. Yeah, that's George Lakoff. Don't think of an elephant. You know.
But definitely, what dominates in the world is the strong father model. Mm-hmm. You know, our legal system, the solving problems through threat, or solving problems through intimidation,
through
punishment. Dominates over the, let's say, the feminine way, which is believing in the loving and in understanding people.
Right. If you love the person enough, they will come back to their wholeness. And that brings us actually to this, what we called the dawn of wholeness in our topic. What does wholeness look like? We're almost out of time, but I want to take an extra 5 or 10 minutes to come to this next movement of how do we become whole in our search.
Yes, of course, every seeker has a thirst for wholeness and will move towards wholeness with whatever resources are available. But if we want the world to become a world of healthy people, and we understand health to be wholeness, I don't think we can do it through therapies or religions or cultural movements. I think we need to... It's impossible to change so many people who, by the way, don't want to be changed.
Yeah, that's really hard. You start. You can't beat someone over the head and tell them to change if they think they're just fine.
That's why I think that only education could do it, but not the education we have, which is part of the problem.
Right. We divide children up and put them in little boxes and tell them to study little boxes so that they can check the right boxes.
It's an education for transmission of information at best, because actually I don't think that's so much that, but education for passing exams, rather. It's education to get a ticket to get into the work market.
Right, it's a socialization to create industrial machinery.
Yes. education for... it's a fraud. It's education for production, for the productive system. I say that education is the invisible partner of the military-industrial system.
What's the answer then? What is this kind of education you're talking about?
I think we need a education revolution, a radical change in the scope of education, making education for human development a priority. And for that to happen, there has to be a political will that has not happened. I think there has to be only the money world, the corporate world, maybe the globalized money world could have the power to decide we're going to finance a global educational reform. We're going to bet on consciousness. I think the revolution that is needed from education, patriarchal education, to education for growth is at the same time an evident need and something that educational institutions are deaf to. So I'm very interested in creating and contributing putting my energies in, and when I give talks, into moving the public to become aware of this, that we cannot expect a better world if we don't have a better consciousness, and we can't have globally a better consciousness if we don't change education, because we have the world we have because we have the education we have, or because we don't have other education than the one we have.
Well, in the United States, with our ridiculous No Child Left Behind Act, which has caused teachers to have to focus more and more on regurgitated facts and less on the whole child or the whole consciousness development, are you seeing more openness to change in the countries you've worked in, like Chile and Spain and Italy and Brazil and Mexico?
I've been very disappointed. Aside from Scandinavia is better, but generally there's a great blindness. It's a world phenomenon that teachers are sick and depressed and burnt out. Teachers can't function in a kind of prostitution, which is lending their life's energies to something that doesn't have meaning. They're paid to do something that is not what they were what corresponds to their vocational choice. They want to help, to transmit values, to transmit humanness, and they find themselves in a box, in a system where they can't do that. But the young and the children and the students don't want education, and the system doesn't understand that they don't want education because they are more aware than the teachers about the meaninglessness of education.
Right. Well, they have now.
They are blamed.
They now have access to the whole world through the internet, and they know that there's more than they're getting in their classroom, certainly. But and there's individual schools and people who are trying to create whole person education around. But what do you think it's going to take to actually create the revolution? Does the whole system have to collapse, or do all the children have to walk out as one and say, we're not going to put up with it anymore? It's not going to come from the corporations, I don't think.
I think... I think it needs to. We need to try to make it come from corporations. Corporations talk a lot about social responsibility lately, And it's mostly propaganda. It's like we give for the end of pollution, we give for ecology, we give for this. It
right.
looks
oh,
good.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's not.
Greenwashing is what we call it, yeah.
What? Yeah.
We call it greenwashing, yeah. Just
yeah, exactly.
Look how socially
yeah.
responsible we are. So somehow, if it was realized at some level of corporate business that whole persons function better in the world and function better in their companies as employees, they might get interested. So somehow we have to show them that there's a benefit to whole person education instead of narrow casting education. And in an unchanging world, it's good to have everybody know how things are, but we have a world in which things are changing so quickly that we have to be more comfortable with uncertainty than with certainty. And I think that can only come out of the kind of education you're talking about.
And there's also the hope that as the corporate world is getting interested in the human development of their people, both because leaders want to take leadership courses and because those who are on top want the employees to be happier at work. So a lot of what was the human potential movement is coming now into the corporate world, and where there is individual transformation, institutions also transform.
Well, then,
so
yes,
the project becomes believable.
So there is some hope that that we can move the educational system inch by inch, or maybe we need to throw it all away and start over.
One or the other.
One topic I wanted to cover before we end, and we're going over, but it's so interesting talking with you. I so appreciate your being here with me. We talked about developing caring. You know, you talked about the feminine nurturing and caring as a natural response of the limbic
yes.
system. We've got this very harsh world where men are taught not to care about their bodies, not to care about other people. Can you learn caring? Is that a possibility? Can you develop that aspect of self, and can we bring that into our lives?
It's a great question whether it is learnable, because it almost seems hopeless through so many people who have gone through so much and still are short on that. And there's a lot of fake caring in the world. There's a kind of seductive love that is a kind of false coin. Two things are important to understand. The Christian notion, love thy neighbor as thyself, actually has not been put into practice, or has not, let's see, there is that precept, but the common understanding, what the culture tries to do is promote a love of others without the basis of self-love.
Right, I was going to say that if you're loving your neighbors as yourself, that's not going to be very good, because most people don't love themselves.
That's right. So I think it's important that to recognize that if we want a more caring world, and that's basically, Dalai Lama goes around the world giving talks basically on this subject.
And he says kindness is my religion.
It's all kindness. Is what the world will need, what the main factor in the future is that people be a little bit more kind.
And we saw in Joplin, Missouri, for example, after the huge tornado that tore up
yes.
the town, that the people were actually out in the streets hugging each other, holding each other, crying together, inviting each other into their houses, taking care
yes.
of each other.
Yes. The people react like that, but the authorities certainly don't, like it was so clear in Miami.
Right. So do we need more disasters to care more and to come into wholeness, do you think?
Hopefully not. I think if there were an education geared to making people more kind, that would have to include first making people more wild. I like to talk about a Dionysian spirit, a spirit of freedom, a spirit of belief in nature and natural impulses, because there is an education into self-antagonism, an education for perpetuating this split of the mind into a top dog and an underdog, a persecutor, one who demands and the other who pleads, and so forth. This basis of neurosis is educated, and so you cannot think of an education for kindness without first thinking of an education for freedom, for becoming uncastrated.
So uncastrated is sort of a kind of a reverse surgery, right?
Yeah, but, right.
So good. So I want to point people toward your website, which has a tremendous amount of good material on it, claudionaranjo.net. That's C-L-A-U-D-I-O.
Yes.
N-A-R-A-N-J-O.net. And Claudio, do you have a mailing list that you maintain?
No, I don't.
Okay, so
a mailing list.
So
I move in, and I go to different organizations that hire me, and I don't have an audience of myself, of my own.
Good. So if you want to hire Claudio, you can get to
the website. The website.
Yeah. Good. Go to the website. We have time for a few questions. So if you'd like to ask Claudio a question, press 1. There's a question. I'm not sure what this refers to, but a question that came in over the web. Is this phenomenon only in the West? And so I'm going to assume that the writer is asking about this split in the consciousness of the inner patriarchy that dominates. So is that, do you see that more in the West than Eastern cultures,
no,
for example?
No. Where there is civilization, all civilizations are repressive. Indian civilization, Chinese civilization, we may find great wisdom in each, but the massive quality of being, what is the reality of the culture, is the turning against inner nature and outer nature as well.
I liked what Mahatma Gandhi said when he was asked, "What do you think of Western civilization?"
It would be a great idea.
Thinking about it for a moment, he said, "That would be nice."
Yes.
So we have a question from Muriel. Muriel, go ahead.
Oh, I'm so appreciative of this conversation. Thank you so much. I was very struck by what you said, that before kindness must come wildness. And so my question is the wildness more associated with the feminine even than with the masculine? Not so much like with men and women, but just the awareness of the difference in within of the feminine and the masculine.
Yeah. Is wildness a feminine phenomenon, or does it come out of the child?
I think of it as a child. It's the child in all cultures has been domesticated, and we need to undomesticate. The feminine is a pro-child. The feminine is love and is nurturance. So the mother principle is always for the child, but it's different from the wildness itself, which is the child itself.
We're talking about the child mind inside all of us, right? The part of us. We all have that inside of us.
We all have an animal wisdom.
Well, that brings to mind a partner question having to do with how important is it in bringing up a child for the focus to be on grokking the child, comprehending who is this individual, even when they're very, very young, instead of trying to socialize the child.
Yes.
The best parenting model for providing safety and guidance and yet letting that wildness express.
That's good, Mariel. So let's hear from Claudia. What is the right balance?
I think it's important to recognize that we need wildness. We need not to criminalize our desiring system, our instinctual nature. But we need also to learn control. Only that the way that control is taught is by making ourselves bad. It's already in the myth of the bad snake that tempted Adam and Eve. The snake originally was the goddess, the spirit of nature. So it's an art to be able to say no without making desire wrong.
It's a very powerful statement all by itself.
The Greeks have their two great gods, Apollo and Dionysus. Apollo has to do with control and Dionysus with letting go. And these two gods were presided over the mysteries, the Apollonian mysteries and the Eleusis mysteries of Dionysus. And they understood that these two go hand in hand, but they are apparently opposite. So it's a mystery of life, or that... I think it's an art. Great educators, like, for instance, the Wild, Rebecca Wild in Ecuador, who founded the Pestalozzi School there and has written wonderful books, focuses very much on this, the need to educate for freedom, but also teaching limits.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We have time for one more question. Someone called in on the general pin and pressed 1, so say your name if that's you.
Leroy.
Leroy. Did I get
that
right?
Yes, that's correct.
Go ahead and ask your question of Claudio.
Yes, sir. On your website, sir, what kind of bird is that? That is the most awesome, colorful bird, and we just wondered if it was, what kind of bird is it from nature?
No, I don't think it's from nature. I thought, how will I organize my different specialties into a design? So I thought, well, I listed them. I realized half of them were things in the spiritual domain and the other half in the psychological domain. So I thought they could be feathers in the left and right wings of a bird. And I asked a friend to draw a bird for me. And this friend, a neighbor, Jacqueline Scardova, who was a children's book illustrator, did this bird for me. But I did tell her, make me a firebird, because I thought the bird is composed of flames. So the feathers would be like flames. In retrospect, after the fact, I would say it's a phoenix. A phoenix has a mythical bird of death and rebirth.
Yes, and there's a Russian myth about the firebird, also
yes.
The firebird suite by Stravinsky.
But this firebird is a phoenix, and I hadn't thought about it when I asked for that drawing.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for that question. Claudia, we must end, which is painful to me because I've had such an enjoyable time talking with you and dialoguing with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all of you who have joined us this morning on Saturday. I'll give you a little bit about what's coming up today. My next conversation is with two Western shamans, Gary Stamper and Tom Pinkson. We're talking about the warrior spirit, an ancient imperative for modern man. So if you are interested in shamanism, be sure and tune into that. Both are amazing men who have long trained in shamanic practice. At 12:30, and that one's coming up at 11 o'clock in just 10 minutes. At 12:30, my co-host Stephen Dinan will be talking to Chris Kyle, a wonderful friend and a brilliant athlete and intellect and businessman. He's going to be talking about activating your mission and creating your world. And then I'm back at 1:30 with the amazing Steve Behrman, who is also known as Swami Beyondananda and has written a book with Bruce Lipton called Spontaneous Evolution, a way of looking at how we evolve as human beings. So that's the topic there. He will not be appearing as Swami Beyondananda, but he's always very funny. And at 2:15, Stephen will be back interviewing Michael Tamura, a visionary teacher and psychic healer and teacher of psychic development. And again, tomorrow on Sunday, we have a panel in the morning on Knights Without Armor, the quest for the courage to be vulnerable, and then the illustrious Robert Moore joining us at 12:30 to talk about masculine spirituality and initiation. and then an hour or more for you to honor your fathers at 1:30. Thank you so much for being with us. So appreciate you, Claudio, and all your work on behalf of humanity. Thank you.
Thank you. You do such a great job.
Thanks.
And I don't know where you get so much energy for.
I'm having a really good time. That's where I get it.
That's it.
So thank you all. We'll be back at 11 o'clock.
Yes.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Claudio. Thank you.